here. It is such an honor to have met some of you over the weekend and to have gotten to know some of you, even if it's just sort of in passing. And you never know where our paths will cross again, maybe at the OA birthday, maybe at a world convention, you never know. We have been talking about the program of recovery. We've been talking about the steps. We've been talking about the nature of this illness. It is an illness of the mind and an illness of the body. And the mind is triggered by the buildup of human emotion. And the buildup of human emotion is something that is common to all people, to all human beings. There's no way to avoid it. There's absolutely no way to avoid it. And when we are children, oftentimes the culture and the society that we live in teaches us to stifle those emotions. We say we're scared, and somebody says there's nothing to be scared of. We say we're angry, or we're hurt, or we're this, or we're that. And people around us will say, no, you're not. Don't be that way. And those emotions continue to build up within us. And as those emotions continue to build up within us, what happens is we find solace in food. That food and the effect therefrom will give me the relief that I seek. And that relief comes in the form of something that is lethal to me, and it is killing me. Because I not only have the twist of the mind, but I also have the allergy of the body. And as a person who has the allergy of the body, I will find it impossible to stop once I've started. That in a normal person's body, the more they eat, the less food they're interested in. They get satisfied and they're done. They're just done. But in my body, the more I eat, the more I want, the more I want, the more I eat, the more I eat, the more I want, and it's just endless. There's no end to it. And so we have been living in a cycle of death since we were little children. I know that for me, this disease tore me asunder from the time I was a toddler, before I had language. This disease ripped me apart. And it laid in its path destruction wherever it landed in my life. It tore me apart. It emasculated me. It deformed me. It amputated me from any dream I could have dreamed of a better life. God came into my life through you, and I'm alive today to tell the tale. Let's take a look at steps 10, 11, and 12, and let's see if we can dispel some of the rumors and mistakes that people make with step 10. Step 10 is a vital, vital part of lowering the level of these emotions. 2 and 10 are the most underutilized from what I've seen in almost 40 years, and 3 and 4 are the most misunderstood. But let's take a look at step 10 and let's dispel some of the rumors or mistakes that people make when they're doing these steps. Let's go to page 84 if you're following at home, page 84. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. Let's look at the word continue and let's see how many times it's mentioned in the paragraph. We vigorously commenced this way of living as we cleaned up the past. Stop right there. Rumor mistake number one. We vigorously commence. To commence means to begin this way of living, step 10, as we cleaned up the past. What steps do we use to clean up the past? 8 and 9. So you do not wait until you're done with 8 and 9 to begin 10. You begin 10 as you come out of 5. Once you get out of five, it should take 30 seconds to do step six, 30 seconds to do step seven, and you are ready to go 8, 9, 10, and 11, and 12 very, very fast, very quickly. There should be no delay. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past, meaning we do not wait, thank you, until we're done with step 8 and 9. We begin them simultaneously. Because if I do not have step 10, then the fear of 9, the anger in 9, the jealousy in 9, the emotions in 9 are going to drive me back into the food. I need step 10 to continue with steps 8 and 9. I didn't want to part with that money that I had to pay back. I didn't want to write those checks. I didn't want to apologize for the things that I had done. And were it not for step 10, I would not have the wherewithal to fare forth and do what I needed to do. This is a vital, vital thing that I must have 10 to go forward with 8 and 9. Very important. We have entered the world of the Spirit, and the Spirit is in capital letters. And what does that mean, we have entered the world of the Spirit? For me, it means that as I go forward in my steps, I become the human being that God had ordained me to be at birth without the food. I can say no when I mean no. I can say yes when I mean yes. I can be who I am. I don't have to outthink you to see where I think you want me to be or what you want me to be so that you'll like me and not abandon me. If I get up here and say, I like a red car and you like a blue car, that's perfectly okay. But I'm going to voice my truth. And to me, when I live in the Spirit, that means that I have a voice that says, here's who I am. That doesn't have to denigrate who you are or try to get you to like me or whatever that may be. It means that I am holding God's hand and He likes me. And the more truthful I am, the more honest I am without being brutal. You know, honesty without love is brutality. Love without honesty is sentimentality. As long as I'm not being brutal, I can tell you that it is freezing in this room and I'm dying of pneumonia up here. But I can honestly tell you that. But the bottom line is that I don't have to be a Cubs fan or a White Sox fan or a Bears fan just because you are. I love those teams anyway. But what it means is when I'm living in the world of the Spirit, thank you, when I'm living in the world of the Spirit, I honor who I am without thought of how I'm going to get you to like me and not abandon me. I hope that makes sense. It's so important, and we can read past that line, and we can read past it and not think a thing of it, but it is vital. We have entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. How do I grow in understanding and effectiveness? By doing the steps, working with others, gaining knowledge from those people that God has put in my path. When I sponsor someone and they call me, as they do every day, I always let them go with this: thank you for helping God keep me out of the food for another day. Because were it not for them reaching to me, I would not learn. I would not be the person that I am today. It has been my honor and privilege to have been sponsored by some wonderful people and to have sponsored others in return and to work with people, even if I'm not their sponsor, even if it's just an outreach call. When you make a 10-step call to me, I grow as a human being. And the other thing that's very, very important for me to remember is when I am doing this, I have to refer back to page 570 in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I go to page 570 in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, what I find in the first paragraph by Dr. Bauer is this sentence: "They know that they must never drink. They help others with similar problems. In this atmosphere, the alcoholic often overcomes his excessive concentration upon himself. If you make a 10-step call to me, and for that 2-minute period of time, I am not concentrating on me, and I'm thinking about you, you are giving me a gift that I couldn't give you gold for, because I may not be much, but I'm all I think about. And if I can take a respite from this self-absorption, this self-obsession, I am moving closer to God and further away from a Twinkie. And everything I do today, everything I say today, everywhere I go today, I'm either moving toward God or I am moving toward the food, and there's no middle ground. There's no middle ground whatsoever. I must have others in my life. This is a we program. What is the first word of the first step? We admitted we were powerless over food and our lives have become unmanageable. This was not a program to be worked in isolation. It is a program that breaks down that agoraphobic attitude of isolation. It is a program that puts me in better touch with other people. Some of you I have known very, you know, from a distance for a long time, but it's a familiar face. It's a familiar face. I walked in here. I've been a delegate from the Phoenix Serenity in the Desert Intergroup is the name of our intergroup, Serenity in the Desert. And I see Richard. And I have somebody that's a familiar face. That's a gift. That's a gift. And that comes from service. That doesn't come from sitting at home and looking at the wall. That comes from getting out there and doing service. So that's a big part of it too. Huge part of it too. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. And I get this call maybe 150 times a year from somebody who says, I had abstinence, I had recovery, and now I'm back in the food. What I will find out is they either never started doing 10 and 11 and 12, or they stopped doing it. They stopped doing it. And this should continue for our lifetime. And if I do not continue this for my lifetime, I'm not going to recover. It's that simple. This disease of compulsive overeating is permanent. It is progressive. It is fatal. The only remedy that we have is a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. There is no other remedy. The diet that you want to go on, or the whatever you want to do, it's not going to relieve you of the effects of this disease. It just is not. There is one remedy, a spiritual awakening. This is exactly how that is achieved. It should continue for our lifetime. And what's the first word of the next sentence? Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. What step did we use to deal with selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear? Step 4. When these things crop up, not if, when these things crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. What two steps does that call us back to? 6 and 7. We discuss them with someone immediately. Second mistake uncovered. We do not do step 10 at night and in the morning. That's 11. You can do them at night and in the morning, but it's not limited to that. We discuss them with someone immediately. How long can you hold your breath underwater? How long are you going to sit there being angry? How long are you going to sit there being scared? Pick up that phone. Make that call. Discuss it with someone immediately, step five. And make amends quickly, steps 8 and 9. If we have harmed anyone, then we resolutely means with purpose, turn our thoughts to someone we can help, step 12, love and tolerance of others is our code. In that little sub-paragraph, you have worked 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 12. I dare you, I challenge you to do 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 12, 5, 6, 7 times a day and eat chocolate cake. You cannot do it. You cannot do it because your mind will not allow you to hurt yourself like that. Now, think of it this way. What were you promised in step 2? Sanity. Sanity. And that is the key here. When we are practicing this, the urge to eat is simply not there. If you're new and you're here and you're wondering what that's like, do the steps. Have a spiritual awakening as the result of those steps, and you will find that this thought in your brain of excess food or food that is wantonly just destructive, it will not be there. I promise you in front of God and all His children that we are people who are refraining from compulsive overeating who are doing this, and we are doing so happily. That there is no struggle. There is no, oh my God, I'm stark raving abstinent. I'm hanging from the chandelier. It doesn't go, it's not like that. How long do you think we would sit up there and hang from the chandelier being stark raving abstinent? We couldn't do it. This program would not be workable. It is a freedom. And step 10 is one of the building blocks of that release from the horror of this illness. And if I'm not doing 5, 6, whatever it is, step 10s a day, I'm probably in very serious denial. Probably in very serious denial. Because things are going to come up. Things are going to come up. People are going to piss me off, I'm telling you. And it's going to happen. You know, when I get home to Scottsdale, it's going to be 90 degrees, which is nice. But I'm going to be coming out of the airport in Phoenix. And guess what? There's going to be thousands of other people coming out of that airport, too. And some of them got their driver's license in a Cracker Jack box or whatever. So, I kid. But the bottom line is, I need this. And it doesn't mean that every time something flitters in my mind, I do a 10-step. But if it's recurring 2, 3, 4 times I'm thinking about this, uh-oh, time to get out Mr. Cell Phone. It's easier to recover now than it's ever been because we all have, you know, used to be, first of all, these guys didn't even have phones. They would go to each other's homes. And you'd have Bill Dotson, and he'd go over to Dr. Bob's house and knock on the door, and he'd bring his whole family. This is in the depths of the Depression, and the Smiths would say, come on in and have dinner with us, and Bob and Bill would go in the other room and they would do their 10th step. It's easier to recover now than it's ever been. You know, and they have cathedrals in all the buildings. Some are marked men, some are marked women. You know, they have places where you can do this. You know, they have little cathedrals. You can go in there and do your thing and do what you need to do, you know? So it's easier than ever. Now, let's take a look at what this next section of the book is. Now, there's a question that I get asked, and not only I get asked, a lot of people get asked, what is the difference? Why do some compulsive overeaters say, I'm a recovered compulsive overeater? What does that mean? That means that these 10th step promises have come true for me in my life, And let's take a look at what they are so you'll know what is the difference between someone who is recovered and someone who is recovering. This is the difference, and this is where it is. I'm at the bottom of 84, and we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. And what am I promised in step two? I am promised that my higher power will return me to sanity. And if I need to be returned to sanity, I must have been insane. Well, let's take a look at that for just a second here. Why would anybody who weighs 335 pounds as a senior in high school eat boxes and boxes of candy bars and eat 15 Egg McMuffins a day and eat Oreo cookies until they're coming out of my nose? No sane person would do that. You know, many of us know people that have peanut allergies, or they have shellfish allergies, or whatever it is. You know, my friend with a shellfish allergy doesn't say to himself, you know, instead of shrimp, maybe this time I'll try lobster and see if that doesn't make me sick. They don't do that. They don't do that because the shrimp doesn't do for them what the food does for me. What does the food do for me? It gives me an effect. It gives me an instant sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly by eating the food. It is a very, very powerful drive, that effect. What does Dr. Silkworth say? I didn't use the drool. He says, most alcoholics drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That's what I liked from the Oreo cookies. But what I didn't like was what it did to my waistline and breaking out in blubber and so on and so forth. But it says here, and now, before I move on, I don't do those things to myself anymore. I treat myself as I would treat you. You know, if you came to my home for dinner, I wouldn't feed you a chocolate sundae. I have more respect for you than that. But I didn't have respect for myself. I didn't have the necessary respect for the soul that God put in my body. I don't want to get religious on you now, but I'm going to just tell you something. There's three Israels. Israel is in heaven. Israel is a country. But there's Israel right here, right here, right here in my heart. That holiness, that neshama, that spirit, I spit on it. I degraded it. I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to. I had an illness, but I dragged that little boy through pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and I'll be damned if I'm going to do it again. Now that I know better, I'm not doing that again. I absolutely refuse. I refuse to do it again, but I need God's help or I cannot be successful because the lure of the food is too inviting. And so I need to do this and I need God's help. For by this time, sanity, step two, will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. Every once in a while, I will get a thought when I walk into the grocery store. They'll be baking something or cooking something or whatever they'll do. And I'll get a whiff of it. And that smells good. That smells good. And I'll entertain it for about 15 seconds, this idea of indulging in it. But then that thought is it's done. I walked into the grocery store the day before I came here to Spokane. And there was Halloween candy up to the ceiling. You know, I almost feel sorry for Halloween and Thanksgiving. It's like they're in the way. You know, the stores are just waiting to bust out the Christmas stuff. But for right now, it's Halloween, you know. The other thing I'll say to you about Halloween in Scottsdale, Arizona, it's not like when I was a kid, you heard all the kids yelling at their mother, Superman doesn't have to wear a coat. But by the end of October in Chicago, you better wear a coat if you're going out trick-or-treating because it's cold. cold. It's cold there now. I think it's in the 40s right now back home. But anyway, in Scottsdale, the kids go trick-or-treating in sandals and shorts and t-shirts, and it's a whole different phenomenon, a very different phenomenon. But I don't even see the candy. The only reason I saw it is I thought, I'm going to mention this when I get to Spokane, that it doesn't even really faze me. It doesn't even faze me. I couldn't care less. It'd be like looking at the feminine hygiene products for me. I don't even care. I don't even care. If tempted, we recoil from it as if from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. It comes when you do the work. It comes when you're doing the first 9 steps and step 10. That's when it comes. That's when it comes. That is the miracle of it. We're not fighting it. Neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. I feel very safe and very protected. I did my knee on June the 5th. I did my knee surgery. So there were offers that I had to travel during the summer that I turned down because I knew that there'd be no way I was going to be ready to travel in airports and stuff like that. And on September the 15th, I went to Orange County, California. I went to Yorba Linda, California in Orange County. And why am I talking about Yorba Linda? Oh, when I came back, it was a Sunday, I came back to the airport like I'm going to do today, and some goof put his car in front of Terminal 4 with the motor running, and he abandoned the car. He wanted to help his girlfriend get her luggage in and get her ticket. And when they see an abandoned car with the motor running in Phoenix, they will shut that terminal down within 2 seconds. And they had the robots and the bomb squad, and they had all kinds of law enforcement out there making sure that this car wasn't going to blow. Because Terminal 4 at Sky Harbor Airport is the busiest of the terminals by a long shot, and they didn't want anybody to get hurt. So I was stuck in Orange County. I was supposed to take off at 10 a.m., and we didn't take off until 3 o'clock, 3:30. They had to make sure that this was okay and all this other stuff. And I was okay. There were other people around me going crazy. They were going cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs over it. And they were yelling at the guy behind the counter, you know, and they're yelling at the woman behind the counter and screaming and yelling, and don't you know who I am, and I'll have your job, and I'm going to sue you. And they're saying to the guy, the airport in Phoenix is closed. There's nothing we can do. And they're yelling and screaming. And I thought to myself, there but for the grace of God walk I. I don't have to go make amends to the 20-year-old and the 19-year-old behind the counter. I don't have to go back and make amends to them. I don't have to eat McDonald's French fries over it. I can just say, oh, well, the airport's closed. Worst that'll happen is I'll spend the night in Yorba Linda. I'll get a hotel room, or I'll do whatever it is I need to do, and I'll be okay. That's not who I am. But that's how I reacted. But that reaction doesn't come from me. It comes from God. Because I am the neurotic. I'm going to control the situation, and I'm going to demand, just like these other people were doing. They showed me what I don't want to be. And the only way for me not to be that way is to do this work. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. 6 days a week, I go to a swimming pool, and I used to ride a stationary bike 6 days a week. But since I've had my knee replaced, what I do now is an exercise that I didn't even know was an exercise before. I walk in the water against the resistance of the pool, against the resistance of the water. And when I walk, I bend my left leg as far as I can and I kick it out. And it's hard to do that because the water will resist you. And it has really helped me. I popped up 10 pounds post-surgically and now I've lost 7 of those pounds back. I've lost 3 of those pounds back. I'm still carrying 7 pounds since the surgery, which I don't like, it makes me icky. But I've lost 3 pounds, but I'm gaining strength from doing this exercise. This walking in the water is like a whole new breakthrough for me. I never, but you wouldn't tell me, the point that I'm trying to make here is, you wouldn't say to me, do it once a month. You wouldn't say to me, do it twice a year. In order for me to keep in fit spiritual condition, I have to treat that as I would a physical condition, and I have to do it every day. I don't do 10 steps 5 days a week or 6 days a week. I do them 7 days a week. I don't do my steps just a few days here and a few days there. The food never said to me, I'm going to take a day off. The food never said to me, you know what? For today, you don't have to go to McDonald's. It's okay. We'll skip it. No, food never said that to me. So if I want to keep in fit spiritual condition, you better know that I'm going to have to work at this. This is not a program for people who need it. This is not a program for people who want it. This is a program for people who do it. This is a program of action. Recovery is a verb. Recovery is a verb. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. Why is alcohol a subtle foe? Because the emotions which drive you irresistibly into it are constant. They're constant. And when you're resting on your laurels, you're already in relapse, you just haven't picked up the food yet. You just haven't picked up the food yet. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day, underline that word, every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. And here's your 10-step prayer. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. I must say that prayer 50 times a day. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, not suggestions, directions, and we have begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us, is capitalized, His Spirit. Whose Spirit? Our higher powers. Our higher powers. His Spirit into us. Whatever it is you believe is fine, as long as you're willing to believe that there is a power greater than yourself. Sorry. To some extent, we have become God conscious. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense. We must go further, and that means more action. Now, I'm going to take you back to Akron, Ohio. It is the summer of 1935. Dr. Bob got sober on June the 10th, 1935. Now I'm going to take you back to the summer. And they're looking for prospects to work with. And they find Bill Dotson. Now there was two Ernie G's actually. There were people that they failed with. But they looked for Ernie G. And they looked, and he wasn't going to recover. And they looked for a couple of other guys. And then they found Bill Dotson. And Bill Dotson really charged them up. You know, if they found him, there's got to be others, you know. And Mrs. Smith, Ann Smith, Bob's wife, would stand at the door and she would hold up her hand and tell the boys, did you do your quiet time yet? And they had to go back into the living room and sit down and do their quiet time. Prayer is us talking. Meditation is us listening. Now we're going to transcend from petition to prayer. What does that mean? Petition is, Please, can I have a silly putty? Please, can I have a yo-yo? Please, can I have a bike? Please, can I have a catcher's mitt? That's petition. That's not prayer. Prayer is asking God for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Prayer is asking God how we can be more effective at carrying the message. Prayer is talking to God. Now, it's okay to tell God, somebody's sick, somebody's sick. That's perfectly fine. I'm not here to tell you what prayer should be for you. I am not the judge and the jury of what prayer is. But we're going to learn what prayer isn't, is sitting here praying, let me win the lottery, let me win the lottery. That's not prayer. That's petition. And I'm going to transcend between petition and prayer. So let's take a look at the bottom of 85, step 11. Oh, and they would take their quiet time. So the prayer is one thing, but the meditation can be different things for different people. I walk a mile in the morning. I used to do 6 miles, but now I don't have my German Shepherd and my knee is new and all this. I walk 1 mile and I'm glad I got that. And while I'm walking, the desert is just beautiful. Oh my God, Scottsdale's gorgeous. It can be really oppressively hot in the summertime, but it is just gorgeous, just absolutely beautiful, especially this time of year. I mean, it's paradise. And I walk and I listen to myself breathe. And when I go on a mile walk, I bring my cane. Since the surgery, I bring my cane. And I can hear the tap, 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 tap of the cane. And there's a cadence that starts to develop. That cadence, I can hear God. I can speak to God. I can hear God. I can speak to God. And this is something that I treasure. This is something that I value above anything else, is my quiet time with the Almighty. I also do writing in the morning. I write and I read and I pray. This is my time with God. And I don't want to start my day. I don't want to start my life without it. I've gone too many times without it to know that it is vital for my survival. I must have that quiet time. If I need to, I get up a little earlier. I'm a vision person, so the vision meetings start at 4 a.m. I don't want to miss that. Don't want to miss that. So I have to get up before 4 o'clock in the morning and make sure that I take my quiet time. So let's go to the bottom of 85. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than us are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. What is the proper attitude? That there is a God and it's not me, and that the God that I have chosen for myself will listen when I pray. That's my proper attitude. Maybe your attitude has to be something different. I don't know. I'm not here to judge you. I'm not here to tell you what your attitude should be. I'm just sharing what my attitude is. That when I speak to God, He is listening. Does that mean that I get instant results? Absolutely not. Sometimes I have to really, really wait. And sometimes He'll say, I need you to do this, this, and this. And then something will happen. Something will happen. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. Now, why is the nighttime section of 11 before the daytime? Because it's assumed that you've been doing step 10 all through the day. So we're going to take the nighttime review, and that comes first in the book. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Now, that word constructively should be highlighted in your brain, in your book, and in your life. Because a hammer to your head is not one of the tools of recovery. And many of us are very given to self-abuse. So when we review our day, we beat ourselves unmercifully for the mistakes that we've made. It says constructively review our day. It doesn't say destructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? What step do we use to deal with resentment, selfishness, dishonesty, and fear? Step 4. Do we owe an apology? Steps 8 and 9 and 10. Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Step 5. Were we kind and loving toward all? Step 10, love and tolerance of others is our code. What could we have done better? Stop right there. Remember again, this is a constructive review, not a destructive review. Take it easy on you. We love you. Please don't hit yourself in the head with a hammer. Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time, or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. Again, we are reminded to get out of self-obsession and start thinking of others in a positive way. I don't mean in a sick, Al-Anonic way or a codependent way. I mean in a altruistic way, giving with no return, with no expectation of return. On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. In other words, I have to ask God what He wants me to do. You want me to play shortstop today? You want me to play third base today? You want me to play right field today? I'm ready to go in where you send me. I'm ready to go in where you want me to be. Whatever it is you want me to do, that's what I'm going to do. Because when I'm doing God's will, I am safe and protected. I want to go home. I want to get back to Scottsdale. 90 degrees is better than this. No, I'm kidding. But if God says we're going to be delayed a little bit, okay. If, you know, there was the football game last night and the Palouse, and you've got thousands and thousands of people that are probably headed for that Spokane airport. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen. You know what? Worst case scenario, I will spend the night in Spokane. Whatever I can do. Whatever I need to do. Okay. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. When I try to get instead of give, there's never enough. There's never enough. There's never enough money. There's never enough food. There's never enough attention. There's never enough anything. But when I'm looking to give rather than get, I feel very satisfied. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought, or a decision. We relax and take it easy. Relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. Those are instructions, not commentaries. Those are instructions. Relax. God's got your back. It's assumed by this time you've got a workable higher power in your heart and in your brain. Relax. He's got your back. We are often surprised how the right answers come after we have tried this for a while. What used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable we are going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely on it. You have to work on this. You have to work at this. And the more you work at this, the better at it you will become. It's just like anything else. Just because I want something doesn't mean that God wants that for me. He may have something much better in mind. Just because I don't want something doesn't mean that it's God's will. It could be my will. How do I tell the difference? How do you tell the difference between God's will and Harlan's will, if you're me? When it's God's will, things tend to go downstream and they move almost effortlessly. Doors start opening up. I was divorced 8 years ago and I rented an apartment. And I said, you know, I'm not getting any younger. I better buy a house. But I couldn't afford a house with a backyard and not move out to God knows where. I wanted to stay in Scottsdale, so I bought a patio home. It's smaller than, you know, the other ones, and I don't have a backyard, blah, blah, blah. But I live in a wonderful location. I bought the house for, the location is a 10 out of 10. And I went in for the mortgage. Everything was smooth. Everything was smooth. Guy says to me, you know, you've got great credit. And I says, really? Because, you know, when before, there were banks in, there were banks in Chicago wouldn't have given me two dimes and a nickel for a solid quarter. He says, you don't have to pay mortgage insurance with your credit. I says, great. He says, you qualify for 4.25. I says, great. Within a certain, I think it was like 50, 60 days, I was moving into my new house. I was moving into my new house. That's not me. That's God. Now, I had to take the effort. I had to make the effort and go to the bank and apply for the loan. Yes, but everything moved down. We were in Eugene, Oregon. We came down to Arizona for the Fiesta Bowl in 2001, Colorado versus Oregon. Oregon won that day. And we realized, because so many of our dear friends are in Arizona, you know, half of Chicago is down there, and we don't go to Florida. We don't want to mingle with the New Yorkers. But anyway, we go to Arizona, and we came down for the Fiesta Bowl, and we were coming back from Arizona, going up to Eugene, and my daughter and my wife are in tears. And my daughter says to me, I don't want to live in Oregon. I want to live near Bubby. Bubby, I don't really have a mother, but I have a sort of adopted quasi-mom that's been like a mom to me for my whole life. And she doted on my daughter and gave her all kinds of attention. And that's what we were missing in Oregon. We were making a ton of money, but we were very lonely there. So we prayed the prayer, God, bless it or block it. It was a Saturday. We put the sign on the lawn of our home in Eugene, Oregon, on a Saturday afternoon in April of 2002. The next Sunday, we got almost a full price offer. And we sold our home and moved to Scottsdale, Arizona, because we prayed the prayer, bless it or block it. Bless it or block it. And so we started taking the next indicated action, and within a very short period of time, we were a we then, but we moved to Scottsdale, Arizona. And that's how it works for me. I don't know how it works for you or anyone else, but that's how it works for me. We usually conclude the period of meditation that with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be. So we are working steps all the time. That we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no requests for ourselves only. There is that. Again, that instruction. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. Be very clear on that. You've got to check with your sponsors on that one. Make sure this isn't some selfish end around. Make sure you're really looking to help somebody else. We are careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that, and it doesn't work. You can easily see why. Now let's go back to page 13 and I'll show you where this comes from. It's pure Oxford group. Let's go back to page 13 if you have your book. 1-3. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself, except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, and that would be in great measure. Let's go back to page 87. So you see Bill doing this in his story, and this is pure Oxford group, altruism. Remember we talked about that? If circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. If we belong to a religious denomination which requires a definite morning devotion, we attend to that also. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles. What are the principles? The principles are the steps. that we have been discussing. There are many helpful books also. Suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. As we go through the day, we pause when agitated. I pause, pray, and proceed. I pause, pray, and proceed. When agitated or doubtful, and ask the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we are no longer running the show, saying to ourselves many times each day, "Thy will be done." We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. The disease is the most exhausting way of life imaginable. I've got to outthink, outmaneuver, outmanage, and outdo everyone on the planet so I can get my way. That is exhausting. I cannot live that way for 5 minutes and stay out of the food. It just brings up too much emotion and I'm worn out. I'm like a fish that's been on the line. Eventually, I got to come into the boat. I'm just too exhausted. I cannot fight anymore. When I'm running the world, I am exhausted. Now that I'm not running the world, I got a lot more energy. And let me tell you that at my age, any type of energy is good. Any type of energy is good. Now, the next sentence in the book on page 88 is one of the most important sentences ever printed in anywhere at any time. And it simply says, it works. It really does. This works. This works. Look at me for just a minute. I used to weigh over 700 pounds. My legs were not in the same zip code. And this is how I used to walk. This is how I used to have to walk. Look around you. Look at the miracles. They're sitting amongst you. Is it a miracle that the leaves are turning up here in Spokane? It's beautiful. It's very nice. Is it a miracle that this part of the country is just beautiful? It's very nice. But what's the greatest miracle of them all? There are people sitting in this room with an illness of the mind and an illness of the body that compels them to eat food against their will. And they're not doing it now. And they're doing it happily. We didn't build this program to screw you over out of your food. We didn't come up with this book and this program so we could mess with you. We didn't. If it's that hard, you're doing it wrong. If it's that hard, you're doing it wrong because it's not a hard program to do. You need a recovered sponsor, somebody that can help you. If you are a sponsor, would you please raise your hand? If you are a sponsor, look around you. Look around you, new people. There are people, you can put your hands down now. There are people sitting in this room that would love to help you because they know that their lives depend upon it. It works. It really does. And losing that weight is the least of it. I don't know how to describe this to you because my vocabulary is inadequate, but I am alive in every sense of the word because of this program, because of a book written by drunks in 1937 and 38 and published in April of 39. I wouldn't be alive. And there, you know, most of the adults that I knew as a child came out of the concentration camps. Most of them had the numbers on their arm from the camps. And they would grab my face as a little boy. And they would kiss me and feed me and everything else. And they would give me a piece of advice that I didn't understand. They would say, "Live until you die. Live until you die." When you are in the food, you are already dead, but you're still walking around among us. The way to live until you die is to hold the hand of your higher power and walk into the sunlight of the Spirit. You can be alive. There is more to life than weighing and doing this. You're weighing yourself, I mean, weighing yourself and crying and getting upset. And every the two most traumatic things I had to do, buy clothes or go to the doctor. Buying clothes, I don't know how it is for women, but for men, it's torture. You know, they put the tape around you and you're just dying. You know, you're just dying because it's got a number on there that you swore to God you'd never be at. You know, normal people adjust their behaviors to meet their goals. We adjust our goals to meet our behaviors. You know, buying clothes is torture. We don't have to live like that anymore. Every garment I am wearing today comes from a normal store. A normal store. I'm not wearing any garment right now that had to be special ordered or special made, or, you know, where they had to send away to Outer Mongolia because that's the only guy that's got size, you know, 82Xs or whatever it is. I'm alive, and so are the people here. Look at their faces. It works. It really does. And there is more to life than making sure that you don't eat this minute. There's freedom. There is freedom. There is emancipation in these steps. I promise you, we're not messing with you. We're not doing that. Try it. See what you can get out of it. And see if I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, call me Pisher. But I'm not. I'm not. Come to other conventions. Come to the OA birthday in January, the 18th, 19th, and 20th. Come to Los Angeles. Come, well, our next world convention is in Orlando, and that's a couple years from now. But come to the conventions. Come to the retreats. Be among people like yourself. Your program will be elevated. For every person I see, there's 20 people that were, they wanted to come here, but they were scared to death. They were scared of what we were going to think of them, which is nothing but love. And they were scared of being away from home and being away from their routines. And they chickened out and they didn't come. But you're here. Don't waste it. For God's sakes, don't waste it. Get into service. We're going to talk about step 12 right now. But get into service. Do what you need to do at the meeting level for sure. And then if you can, get involved in intergroup. Get involved in things. It's going to be a reward that will pay dividends for the rest of your life. This is the most magnificent way of life imaginable. And I don't have to include crap that I have been putting in my mouth from the day I was born. I don't have that shame and that pall of guilt and remorse. And it's beautiful and it works. It really does. It absolutely does. We alcoholics are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in the simple way we have just outlined. But this is not all. There is action and more action. Remember, this is not a program for people who need it. It is not a program for people who want it. It's a program for people who do it. It's going to be on my tombstone. This is not a program for people who need it, not a program for people who want it. It's a program for people who do it. Faith without works is dead. That's Ann Smith's favorite Bible verse from the book of James in the New Testament. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. We don't have the time to go through the entire chapter 7. We're not going to do that. But we're going to talk about step 12. And again, we're going to dispel some of the myths that surround step 12. Let's dispel the first one. This is a three-part step. The first part... part of this step is having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. What myth does that dispel? That you cannot sponsor from where you're at if you haven't had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. Somebody that's on step four who has not had a spiritual awakening should not be sponsoring people up to three. The first requirement of sponsorship is in the book, and it says very plainly, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. That's the first thing. The second thing is, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics. This is the message that we have. We don't have any other message. I am not a healer. I'm not a life coach. I'm not a financial advisor. I'm not a marriage counselor. I'm not any of those things. What I know well. What I don't listen to me. What I know is I know how I worked these steps to get through and navigate the pitfalls that you may be encountering in your life. Some of your pitfalls may be unique to you, and I didn't have them, but what I can do is I can show you through demonstration how I navigated through those things. We are all carrying a message, whether we want to be carrying one or not. You are carrying a message. And I'm reminded of a story that also took place in Eugene, Oregon. It was the summer of 1996. Yeah, my daughter was 19 years old. She was born in December of 94, 95. Yeah, 96. It's a hot Sunday morning, August 1996. My daughter was not quite 2 years old at that time. She was in her diaper. I was in complete relapse at this time. Complete relapse. I was gaining weight in leaps and bounds. And my then wife had just done a major grocery shop, and there was as much food in my kitchen as there was in the store. My little daughter, who looks just like my dad, she speaks English and she doesn't smoke Chesterfield, but she looks just like him. As a matter of fact, as she got older, she even now looks more like him than she did then, which is scary. But she's got his sense of humor, she's got his mannerisms, she's got his way with words. She's him. She's definitely, he came back to haunt me or something. But she's him. Well, in that summer Sunday morning, many years ago, my little daughter, who I valued above anything else, put her little hand on the refrigerator handle, and now I'm in relapse at this time, and she opened up the refrigerator and she turned her little head and said, "Shit, Esther, there's nothing in here." I wonder where she got that. I wonder where she got that. If looks could kill, I would have been vaporized. But this was the message that I was giving this precious little child. This light of my life said, "Shit, Esther, there's nothing in here." Years later, we were living in Scottsdale, and that was the message I was passing to her without wanting to. Years later, we were watching a comedy about two brothers that won the lottery, and they went around making amends to the people that they had screwed over before they won the lottery. And it was the premiere episode of this show. She looks at the TV, she looks at me, she looks at the TV, she looks at me, and she says, "Those guys are just doing 8 and 9, right, Dad?" That's how far she had come. We are carrying a message whether we want to be carrying one or not. We are carrying a message to people. We are carrying a message to the newcomer. And we have a responsibility. And it is a deep, deep, deep responsibility. And I want to tell you something that's very important for my life, and it concerns my friend Scott R. He's dead now. Scott was an actor on Broadway. Very handsome guy. The girls used to go bananas when he would walk in. He's a Jewish guy with black, jet black hair and a dark complexion, 6 feet tall. I mean, they would go bananas for him. And he went out to New York and he got on a Broadway play. And he meets this actress out there. And they decided that when the play was over, they were going to move to Los Angeles. And they were going to try to get into movies or try to get into television. And they move out to Los Angeles, California. And he is an alcoholic and a drug addict. He later became a member of OA, where I bumped into him. But at this time, he was in AA, and it was a Saturday night, and he was answering the phone. You know, people call in and they have trouble. He was on the phone doing service, right? He gets a call in East Los Angeles. Now, East Los Angeles is the bad part of town, or the different part of town. And he and this other guy go out there, and they go to East Los Angeles to a motel. And they're going out to this motel, and they see a guy sitting on the bed. And they talk to this guy for about an hour. And it became very clear to them that he was falling asleep. So they left him alone. They left him alone, and they left. Now, any idiot can count the seeds in an apple, but only God can count the apples in a seed. 5 years later, Scott is the speaker at an Alcathon at the Sheraton in San Diego. Thousands of people are there, and he is the 11 a.m. to 11:50 a.m. speaker. He concludes his talk, and a guy walks up to him and clamps a bear hug on him and says, "You're Scott R." And he says, "Yes." He says, "You saved my life." And Scott says, "I don't believe I know you." He says, "Do you remember about 5 years ago when you and your friend came out to a motel in East LA and you talked to the guy at a motel?" And he says, "Yeah, I remember that." He says, "That guy died not long after you were there. But I was hiding under the bed and I heard every word you said and I haven't had a drink since." Any idiot can count the seeds in an apple, but only God can count the apples in a seed. You do not know where your work is going to go. You do not know who is going to pass it to somebody, even if they themselves do not recover. They could go home and say something offhanded to somebody and it could turn them around. You don't know. You have a responsibility. And there are people that are coming into the meetings and they are broken. And they have paid money to psychiatrists and psychologists and they have had the urine of pregnant women shot up their butt. And they've had their jaws wired shut. And they've had surgeries. And they've been analyzed. And they've been to Weight Watchers countless times. And Nutrisystem and Jenny Craig and all the rest of it. And they've joined the gym. And they've bought clothes that they never wore because they never got down to that size. And their families have rejected them, and their bosses have rejected them, and they're walking in and they're broken, and they're looking for something that might help save their life, and they meet you. Now, at the end of the day, we have to remember what God taught us through Dr. Bob, our teacher. Dr. Bob, at the end of his life in Cleveland, Ohio, 1950, with cancer all through his body, he said to us at the very last, "Let's keep this simple." He says, "What this boils down to is love and service." And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And let's be aware of that erring member among us, the tongue. Let's use it judiciously, because no man looks as good as he does when he is helping another man to stand on the rung of the ladder that he now occupies. And that person is coming in, and they're scared because they don't know any of us. and they feel uncomfortable, remember what Dr. Bob said. It's about love and service. You don't have a master's degree in sponsorship or a PhD. You know what love is and you know what service is. Stick your damn hand out and say, hi, I'm Harlan, I'm Joe, I'm Mo, Larry, or Curly, whatever it is. Stick your hand out and say, welcome to our meeting. Can I get you a newcomer packet? Can I, would you like a phone list or a meeting? Here's a phone list. Don't ask them. Give them a meeting list. Give them a phone list. You know what love is and you know what service is. To the world, you're a person. To that person, you can be the world and you can light them up because you can give them something that no one has been able to give them, and that's the hope that if maybe you recovered from this illness, maybe they can too. Because the psychiatrist didn't say to them, I've recovered from this hopeless state of mind and body. The leader at Nutrisystems never said to them, I've recovered from this. But you can tell them something because you speak and you understand the language of the heart. And they've never heard it spoken as eloquently. God's got a job for you. God's gonna send you in where He knows you are needed. You are uniquely qualified to carry this message. No one else. We could go to any building here and there is nobody qualified to carry the message. It's you. You have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Let's keep it simple. It's love and service. We all know what love is, and we all know what service is, don't we? And so we can honor Dr. Bob, and we can honor our teachers, because every time you walk into a meeting of Overeaters Anonymous, you are walking on the shoulders of giants who went before you. You are walking in on the shoulders of people who recovered and some did not. But they remain cautionary tales to us so that we know what not to do. Honor them. Honor them. Serve. Get involved. Get involved. It is your responsibility to do this, because if you don't do it, you're not working a 12-step program, you're working an 11-step program. And that's not what you want. And in the process of doing this service, you'll get to like yourself. I like me now. I hated me for decades and decades of my life. And you will find a transformation. You will resolve to be compassionate and helpful of the weak, the elderly, the wrong, and the unknowing. You will be an aid to the striving, and you'll gain a knowledge that in your life, you will be all of those things. And you will be more compassionate with others and more compassionate with yourself. And those are some of the gifts that you didn't come in here to get, but you will get them if you do the work. You want to know what I'm sick of? I'm sick of seeing the same people doing the same service in OA year after year after year after year after year. I'm sick of it. I'm sick of it. We need you. We need you. Because it's got to be that way. And there are transformations within yourself that you will be astonished by. As the food turned rancid every area of your life, the recovery will give you hope and lift you up. It will lift you up. And you owe. Because in 1935, a spark was struck in Akron, Ohio. And that spark, as unlikely as it did, as unlikely as it should have been, made it to a guy. His name was Jim Willis. Jim Willis, in 1955, in Oxnard, California, he started a group called Gamblers Anonymous. He knew that gamblers needed a place to go for identification that were not alcoholics. In November of 1959, there was a show that ran in California called the Paul Coates Show. It was a talk show. And Paul Coates, that night, had five members of Gamblers Anonymous on his program, and their faces were hidden. And in West Los Angeles, California, there was a housewife watching the show. And her name was Roseanne S. And she watched the show. And she knew that her husband, Marvin, had a friend who was a compulsive gambler, and she felt that maybe if they took him to a meeting, he would be helped. So they took him in late November of 59. And Roseanne sat there at the back of the room with her coat on, listening to the gambler's share. And she identified right down the pike. And she walked up to Jim Willis, who happened to be at this meeting, and she said to Jim, "Do you think a program like yours could help someone like me with their food problem?" And he heard the pain in her voice, and he turned and said, "You know, Roseanne, I don't see why not." And on January the 19th, which is why we have the birthday in January that you're going to go to, on January the 19th, 1960, the first meeting of Overeaters Anonymous took place. Now, in Luling, Texas, there was a guy who lived there. I can hear him now. I can see him now. And his name was A.G. Ainsworth. And A.G. Ainsworth had been afflicted with compulsive overeating his entire life. Big, tall Texan. And he always wore long-sleeve shirts because he had the stretch marks like I do on his arms. And he was quite a guy, A.G. Ainsworth. He's gone now. And he was coming home from a church retreat on a Sunday. And him and his friend Robert had decided to stop off at a German bakery in Luling and load up on cookies and cake and all that other stuff. And A.G. was tired of battling the food. And he said to his friend Robert, in an almost joking way, so that if Robert made him embarrassed that he could say, "Well, I was just kidding." He said to his friend Robert, "Robert," because Robert was an alcoholic in A.A., he said, "Do you think a program like yours, AA, would work for someone like me with food?" And Robert heard the pain in AG's voice, and he turned and said, "You know, AG, I don't see why not." AG Ainsworth knew a woman named Norma B., and Norma B. and AG Ainsworth started a group called Gluttons Anonymous in Luling, Texas. And there were five groups of Gluttons Anonymous. And in Los Angeles, there were 16 groups of Overeaters Anonymous. And one day, A.G. decided to call the central office of Alcoholics Anonymous in New York to see if they knew of anybody that was using the steps for food. And they put him in touch with Roseanne. And on a Sunday night, the five groups of Gluttons Anonymous sent representatives to A.G.'s house, and they called Roseanne S. in her home, and they talked to her, and it was like Stanley finding Livingston. A.G. flew everyone out to Los Angeles in his private plane. And he became the first man in OA because, not that he did anything special, but because the charter of OA forbade men from coming in. It was for women only. He was elected to be the first chairman of the Board of Trustees. And in a vote of 16 to 5, 5 votes for Gluttons Anonymous, 16 votes for Overeaters Anonymous, we became Overeaters Anonymous, and we remain so to this day. Sandy B was brought in. Sandy was an attorney. Sandy was brought in, and together they registered as a nonprofit organization with the United States and with all states, and we were on our way. And we've had our trials and our tribulations. I recommend strongly get yourself a copy of Beyond Our Wildest Dreams. It is a wonderful piece of literature. You should know the history of who we are and how we got to be what we are. Beyond Our Wildest Dreams is by Roseanne S. She's gone now, but if you want to see what she looked like or hear, come to the birthday. We're going to have a loop of film of her being interviewed about the origins of OA. She's our founder. We don't call her our co-founder because she pretty much did it by herself with God, but you owe. Don't you sit there. Don't make me come back here, damn it. Don't make me come back here. Unless you want me to come to Twin Rocks in Oregon. There I'll go. There I'll go. That I like. Okay. But no, Twin Rocks is, if you've never been to a retreat there, go. It's beautiful there. Just gorgeous. Just gorgeous. You're right on the Columbia there and the whole thing. Okay.
How long ago was it you were there?
Oh, got to be 10 years for sure. Got to be 10 years. Maybe more. I don't know. But anyway, you owe. Don't make me come back here. You owe. Don't take your responsibility lightly. There are people who died so you could be here today. No, I'm not exaggerating. They died so you could be here today. And there are people that worked their butts off so you could have what you have. It's easier to recover now. They didn't have podcasts and phone meetings and online meetings, and they didn't have all that. They had each other. That's it. Serve, recover, serve. And lastly, in the 12th step, to practice these principles. What are the principles? The principles are the steps. To practice these principles in all of our affairs. Let's go to page 100 for the promises, the 12-step promises, and we'll do the final benediction. And then if we want to, I'll take a few questions. If not, let's just do the promises first. And before the final benediction, I've got some other things I want to say. Page 100. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. These are the 12-step promises. Now, before the final benediction on page 164, I just want to say thank you to the people who made this possible and worked on the committee. If you worked on the committee, would you raise your hand so we can thank you properly? Thank you. Thank you. And I also want to thank each and every one of you for coming here. I would have hated to give these speeches to an empty room. So thank you, and thank you for touching my life in a very permanent, profound way, because I will take a piece of you with me back to Scottsdale, and I will never forget the time that I had here in Spokane. This is a beautiful, beautiful gathering of people, and I'm so honored to be here. And if this recovery can happen for me, then it can happen for you. Let's go to the final benediction, and then I'll take a few questions, and then Nancy and I, we got to get to the airport because I've got a plane to catch. So let's go to page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God, steps 1, 2, and 3. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows, steps 4, 5, 6, 7. I'm not thinking this morning. Clear away the wreckage of your past, 8 and 9. Give freely of what you find and join us, 10, 11, and 12. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for having me with you today. Thank you. Questions? You want me to do some questions?